This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Have you heard about the Melting Pot Silent Mobile Dance Parties?
Silent dance. Doesn't sound very fun.
Actually, it's a lot of fun. Picture 200 people dancing with headphones to the same music. The Melting Pot Radio Show will have a series of silent dance parties from 8 to 10 p.m. Tuesdays in Portland parks and public spaces. That's Tuesdays from 8 to 10 p.m. For more information and this week's location, go to kboo.fm/silent dance parties.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott.
My name is Celeste Carey, and you are at your community connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the metro area. If you are in the Columbia River Gorges, 91.9, 100.7 in the Willamette River Valley, and what is it on the web?
KBOO.fm.
Indeed.
And today is Monday, March 18th, and we invite you to join us in our morning conversation. Today we will speak with Penny Okamoto, who is the Executive Director of Ceasefire Oregon. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187, and we invite you to call in and share your ideas on how we can reduce gun violence. According to the CDC, in 2011, at least 31,940 people died from gun violence in the United States. In Oregon, in 2009, 413 gun-related deaths were reported. We're speaking about the number of gun violence, the high degree of gun violence in our country and in our society today, and we're seeking to see what we can do to reduce gun violence and how to create a more safe society for all of our citizens and residents.
And additionally, to make a more local focus, we're looking at the Oregon Bill Senate 347, which discusses the school's right to prohibit guns on its property. For those of you who are familiar with the concealed handgun licenses, Oregon has recently allowed that there are open areas that had previously been prohibited for guns now have that opportunity. But there are those who question the wisdom of having guns on schools, and especially in the elementary and high school areas. So we're speaking today with Penny Okamoto to discuss how we can find some common ground to make those areas once again gun-free zones and enhance opportunities for safety for our young people.
So thank you so much for joining us, Penny.
Thank you very much. It's truly an honor to be here. Thank you.
Perhaps we can begin if you just share a little bit about Ceasefire Oregon, its origins, and its mission.
Sure. Murdoch, our mission is to reduce gun violence. plain and simple. We started off in 1994 as a gun buyback or a gun turn-in. That's what most people probably know Ceasefire Oregon as. A group of people got together, raised funds, simply to buy guns back out of the community with the realization of the dangers of having a weapon in the home. Then back in 2001, Ceasefire Oregon joined with an organization called Oregonians Against Gun Violence, and they primarily dealt with legislative work in creating safer gun laws.
Now, you mentioned the gun buybacks and the gun turn-ins, and for those who may not be familiar with it, you got to target guns in a different way. It's not any old gun, but it's more like what kind of guns are laying around that you feel are unused or unsafe or unneeded anymore. Is that correct?
Pretty much. We'll take in whatever weapon people decide that they don't want to have in the home. It's really, you know, up to the gun owner. One of the things that a lot of people really aren't aware about that in Oregon, you had stated just a few moments ago that in 2009 we lost 413 people to gunshot, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But about 80% of those were suicide. So we want to take a look at if you got a weapon in the home, if you're not sure you can store it properly, if you've got little kids, if you're concerned about people who might be committing suicide. The gun buyback was a great way to turn in a weapon, and it's going to get melted down. And then you would get some type of gift card for it. And that was, you know, really the whole idea behind it, a way for the community to turn in weapons in a safe and secure manner, and knowing that they're not going to be used again for some horrid, you know, horrid outcome.
And, you know, recently our nations and our state has become more aware of gun violence in our society, recent gun shootings throughout the nation and here in Clackamas. You have a proposal on Senate Bill 347. Could you explain it to our listeners?
Sure. We've got an hour, so I'm going to explain the history of 347.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was a few years ago, there was a young man who I think is about 26 at the time. He was at the Western Oregon University. He had a concealed handgun license, and he was carrying his weapon with him. He was stopped by the campus police, and the campus police said, "No, you can't carry your gun here." And the young man said, "Well, actually, under Oregon state law, yes, I can." And a lawsuit ensued, and what the Court of Appeals found was that in the Oregon law, people with a concealed handgun license are indeed permitted to carry their weapons into public schools, and that includes Oregon public schools K through 12. The Oregon University system responded after they lost that lawsuit by creating their own rules. And basically they're saying if you have a contract with us, then you may not carry concealed handguns within our buildings. Now, a contract would mean someone who is a student, a teacher, someone who's working with them, even someone who basically is going to some type of game, basketball game or something like that. So that's how the Oregon University systems dealt with that. But this leaves the whole issue completely wide open for Oregon public schools. Oregon private schools are different. Oregon private schools can make their own law, their own rules, basically. Now, in most public schools will state no weapons allowed unless you're a police officer. And a lot of public schools aren't even aware of the fact that, well, indeed, Oregon state law does say that people with a concealed handgun license may carry their hidden weapon onto school grounds. And what 347 will simply do is let the school district decide rather than the gun lobby or rather than the NRA. Some school districts in more rural areas where they don't have access to police as readily might want to have the ability to have people with concealed handgun licenses and concealed guns in their schools. Other schools might not want that, but 347 will give the option to the school district itself about whether or not to have hidden guns in their classrooms.
So it will be a local option.
Absolutely.
You know, one thing that has troubled our country is the discussion of how to reduce gun violence. And oftentimes we have people on one side or the other, either want to, you know, uphold and honor this their interpretation of the Second Amendment, and on the other side, people who would like to get rid of as many guns as possible. In your work, have you been able to find areas of common agreements, common grounds, and is this proposal something that many people on all sides of the issue can agree on?
I think it is, because basically you're giving this decision, especially in Senate Bill 347 about the schools, you're giving that decision basically back to the schools and the school districts to decide what will be best for them. In a broader sense, you know, there are people who are, you know, they're pro Second Amendment and they think everyone should have a gun. We are not anti Second Amendment. We are not against responsible gun ownership. We are not by any means advocating the repeal of the Second Amendment. That's not at all what we're talking about. What we're talking about, we think, is compromise and is middle ground, keeping the Second Amendment and working even under the confines of, I shouldn't say confines, but even working under Heller and McDonald, which were two recent Supreme Court decisions that stated that people have a right to have a weapon in their home for self-defense. However, within Heller and McDonald, the justices have said that doesn't mean you have the right to have any weapon, whatsoever, and carry it wherever. It provides an individual right to a handgun in the home for self-defense. Does that make sense?
Yes, if I understand you correctly, it's limiting it to handguns, and it's limiting it to the type of gun outside of the home. Is that correct?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. So even Justices Scalia and Alito, who are not liberal, they have stated, look, it doesn't mean you can have any weapon you want, and it doesn't mean you can carry it anywhere you want. And it doesn't mean that felons or people who have been adjudicated mentally ill can have a weapon. And that's made very, very clear in Heller and in McDonald. So we feel that everything that we're working on really is something that's a middle ground. Like, for example, letting the schools decide, you know, where or who gets to have a weapon. So, for example, with this Bill 347, if someone comes in with a concealed handgun, and a teacher sees that concealed handgun maybe in someone's purse or briefcase or tucked into a belt, especially after Sandy Hook and Thurston, all these school shootings, the first thing the teacher is going to do is call the police. Well, maybe it's just a concealed handgun license holder and he or she is just there to pick up a child, but still, you know, that's of course going to be a natural reaction for the teacher. So the schools want to have some control over this, and I think that's very reasonable.
Now, within this measure of control, are the schools asking that for those who perhaps maybe because of local control decide to have guns on their campus, are they going to ask for any type of registration or sign in so they know who's carrying a weapon on the campus, or are they just not, they haven't worked out the details at that level yet?
Probably every school is going to do it in their own way. I would sincerely doubt that people would have some type of registration for a school. I'm not sure how that would
work. I'm thinking more of the employers, the employees. So if a teacher comes on, they sign in, I do carry a weapon. Or okay. If a parent comes in to pick up the kid, they do let someone know, okay, I have a concealed handgun license and I am carrying a weapon on the campus. That's what I'm thinking of.
Right.
Has there been any discussion of looking at the details at that level?
Again, that would be left up to each school district. But there are two separate issues there. One is that it's a separate issue as to whether or not a teacher may carry a concealed handgun license into a school. That's actually a separate issue.
Mm-hmm.
Dealing with teachers and the teachers' unions and the contracts that they have. That's a separate issue. But now the issue of the parents coming in who has a concealed handgun, that's really going to be up to the school district. They are going to have to draw up whatever guidelines they want to draw up.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO-FM. Our guest this morning is Penny Okamoto, Executive Director of Ceasefire Oregon. In a few moments, we will open up our lines to have you participate in our conversations. The numbers here are 503-231-8187, and we're asking you to respond to the question, what do you think we can do to reduce gun violence? In regards to that, Penny, you made the observation that 80% of the gun-related death in Oregon was suicide. So this seems to be also a health issue to some degree. How do we address that problem? People who are in some sort of crisis and might take their life.
You hit the nail on the head. This is very much a public health crisis, and a lot of people treat it as a public health issue. Now, let's talk about suicides in particular. First of all, people who have been adjudicated mentally ill are prohibited from purchasing weapons. About 5% of the crimes that we see, these shootings, are actually committed by people who have been adjudicated or judged by the courts to be mentally ill. And we should help these people with whatever possible means we can. They need our help, their families do. But if we focus just on that, that leaves the other 95% of the people who are committing these horrid crimes we're just ignoring them, and we can't do that. But having said that, let's get back to just suicide alone. Excuse me. One of the things that we can do with suicide, to prevent suicide, is to impose a waiting period between the time the weapon is purchased and the time the weapon can be possessed. Most states don't have any waiting period. Oregon doesn't have a waiting period. But a waiting period, a cooling off period, a period of grace where people can think twice. Is this something I really want to do? Because we know that suicide can, in certain cases, be very impulsive. Another thing that people want to think about is safe storage. If you have a weapon in your home, make sure it's locked up. Don't assume just because, you know, you've got a 20-year-old son, you know, well, he knows how to handle guns, everything will be okay. No. You know, maybe he's thinking about committing suicide, or maybe, you know, of course, that's what Adam Lanza did, actually. He took those weapons. So safe storage, waiting periods, and, of course, the whole mental health issue. And a lot of people tend to just kind of brush off suicide as someone's personal choice, but I would remind people that right now, today, in the United States, a United States veteran commits suicide every 80 minutes. So every 80 minutes. Between now and, say, 9:30, 10 o'clock, another veteran in the United States will commit suicide. And firearms are incredibly lethal. They're well over 95% lethal in suicides. So the means matter. When people try to commit suicide by other means, it's not as lethal. So waiting period, safe storage, and, of course, the mental health aspect that we really need to work on. Those are three things that could really help reduce suicide in Oregon.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. We encourage you to call in, have a conversation. We're looking at ways to support middle ground exploration as we look at ways to combat gun violence and reduce gun violence and reduce death by suicide here in Oregon. 503-231-8187. And we'll go to Randy. Thank you for your patience, Randy.
Good morning. Would KBOO have on as a guest, say, someone like Karen Sterrett from Oregon Firearms Federation?
I'm sure
someone would.
I think that'd be wonderful because, we all like balance and to hear both sides. I guess I'll make an attempt to represent the law-abiding gun owner in my call. My contention and our contention is that these laws to, say, prohibit concealed handguns in schools are always preposterous and counterproductive.
And based on?
Well, because you obviously can only control the law-abiding. You're not going to control the person who's determined to cause mayhem.
Okay, we'll let have Penny respond to that. Thank you, Randy.
Yeah, unfortunately, due to the many lax gun laws we have, it's really easy for criminals to get their hands on guns now. We've got over 300 million firearms in the United States in civilian possession. That's way more than any other country. So, yeah, it's pretty darn easy for a criminal to get their hands on weapons at this point. Unfortunately, that Pandora's box has been open, and we're just trying to deal with that as best as we can. But as far as bringing concealed handguns into schools, some of the things that we're taking a look at is accidental discharge, and as a matter of fact, that's already happened several times just since the Sandy Hook shooting. We've got a great blog on that at New Trajectory. We've got a great blog on the... unfortunately, no one's been killed, but the accidental shootings and the problems that have happened with people bringing their weapons into schools post-Sandy Hook. But what we're concerned about is a weapon being left, a weapon being accidentally discharged. Someone bringing, coming into the school, having some type of altercation, reaching for the weapon. So that's what we're concerned about. Having said all that, I have to remind everyone that this issue was really brought to us. We actually weren't really that, there was no problem. We were going to focus on other legislation, but this actually was brought to us. The schools were saying, look, there's this discrepancy. We don't want to have these guns in our schools. We need to have an idea of who's coming in armed and who isn't coming in armed. So that's how it was really brought to us, basically. The schools needed a clarification between what their rules are, which are pretty common sense, and what the Oregon law states.
Thank you, and we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, Joanne.
Yes, hello. I'm not an intellectual person, and I've had to take my Social Security disability and being mentally ill instead of all my medical problems. So therefore, if I wanted to get a gun for protection, I wouldn't be able to. But in the meantime, I'm thinking, our government and that's going to be putting drones and that in our daily life. And so I'm starting to rethink, bans on guns and that. So I'll get off the air and listen to what you have to say.
Thank you. One thing that I often hear, if I may add on before you respond, Penny, is people feel a threat either by the government and feel that they need to stock up weapons because someone might come in to attack their freedom. How do you respond to those type of concerns?
I just don't even know what to say to people sometimes. Sometimes about that. I mean, I hear that about people thinking the government's going to come in and they're going to take my weapons. There's no licensing. There's no registration. How is the government even going to know, who has a weapon? But the other thing too is that if the government is truly going to come after someone, I can't even imagine why. Any type of arsenal isn't really going to make a difference. If people have an issue with the government, it's really better to work within the system. I mean, that's why we have a democracy. So we can actually vote. We don't have to shoot people we disagree with. And of course, the vast majority of gun owners think that's preposterous. You work within the democratic system. The vast majority of gun owners are they're incredibly responsible. They take impeccable care of their weapons. They're unbelievably responsible, safe, keep their weapons in safe storage. Again, it's a whole situation where the people we're really dealing with, the criminals are a small minority, not the vast majority of gun owners who truly are, very responsible people. As far as the drones, I'm not even really sure how to respond to that.
That might be another program.
Well, not only that, but I think you've kind of addressed it in a sense. What we're talking about is the fear. And for a lot of people, they're looking for some way to minimize this vague and ambiguous fear of what's going on in the world and this sense of powerlessness. So when I hear someone say that, my thought would be, how do you recenter it back on the local issue and try to demonstrate we are trying to exercise some measure of control over the things that we can control? So, when I hear somebody say that, I think, okay, what we're looking at is fear reduction here. And if you are creating at least a safe place for our young people where we've got some commonly arrived at ground rules and a common vision of what's safety and a common vision of what is preventing violence, then we help our young people grow up without that same level of fear. Does that make sense?
No, that's just incredibly well said. That's perfect. Beautiful. I can go now. You really, it was great.
Thanks. Well, let's go to our next caller. Good morning.
Hey,
Sean.
Good morning. I think it was Davey D. on Hard Knock Radio who brought up the point about mass incarceration.
Mm-hmm.
We tried prohibition on alcohol. We tried prohibition on drugs. It's resulted in mass incarceration. It's been a complete disaster. Putting more gun laws on the books just seems like one more prohibition to fill the prison industrial complex. It seems to me that if we really want to do something about reducing violence in society, we need to create a much more family-friendly, pro-parent economic system, one that's going to support parents instead of an economic system in which people feel constant anxiety, constant stress. People have no job security if they're lucky enough to have a job. So I'm really upset to hear people on the left, or at least liberals or Democrats, sort of reveal themselves as just sort of pro-establishment, not really interested in doing anything significant about the economy and why people do feel so much anxiety and stress in their lives. And, you know, the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, they were all about arming up, and that's how I feel. Looking at our foreign policy, looking at our economic policy, I'm all about arming up right now. Thanks.
Penny, Celeste, before he spoke, Celeste, you talked about fear and people
right
having
and
that.
And it would have been good to ask a question about how looking at creating a safe environment is ratcheting up controls and prohibitions. What we're trying to do is come at a common ground. And if I understood you correctly, Penny, that's what Ceasefire works for. More gun education, how to be safe with your gun, how not to have guns that are easily accessible laying around, and then also to sit down and have discussions with the responsible gun owner community about how to create a safe place. It sounds as though people are not hearing that.
Well, basically, first of all, I have to say I wish I were responsible for the economy because then I could fix it,
mm-hmm.
but that's way out of my purview, actually. But we do know that when the economy is bad, crimes of all types go up. That's a really well-known, I don't even have a site for it, but it's just very well-known that when the economy's bad, crime goes up.
Or minimally, the fear of crime goes up.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right, exactly. But what we're really seeing here is this really, truly is all about money, even more so than the caller perhaps believes. Because when we're talking about assault weapons ban, so, and people say, I don't even know what an assault weapon is. Well, you know what? General McChrystal knew what an assault weapon was, and he
mm-hmm.
wants to have them banned. Ronald Reagan knew what an assault weapon was, and he wanted to have them banned. So when we're talking about banning these really weapons of war, what the NRA sees, what Bushmaster sees, Bushmaster was made the weapon that was used in the Newtown Massacre, what they see are people who are going to stop their product from being sold.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So really, in the end, what this all comes down to is that the gun lobbies want their money. And we have, like I said before, we have about 300 million firearms in the United States, and we have about 308 million people. So that is a saturated market. And so Wayne LaPierre, Marion Hammer, David Keene, all from the NRA, are, they're shilling for the gun lobby, and they want to make sure that they can sell as many guns as possible. And one of the ways they do that is by saying that your guns are all going to be taken away from you. And that is simply not true. People say Barack Obama, he's going to take our guns away. Let's think about this realistically for a minute. If someone's going to come into office and do something so extreme as taking away everyone's guns, that would be done right away. That would have been done in the first term. You don't wait for your second term to make some type of coup, or it's just not even logical. Okay, so we know that none of that's going to happen. But the NRA, the gun lobby, Bushmaster, Glock, all these people who are making a lot of money selling weapons to our citizens don't want this to happen because they don't want their profits to go away. And that's simply what it's all about. And they've done a great job of scaring a lot of people.
And there in a previous caller was talking about the economy and looking to add a way in which it's a larger problem. I think you addressed it in some issue that for many gun manufacturers, it's an issue of maintaining their profit margin.
On their customer base.
I'm wondering, because you mentioned this fear that, and certainly a lot of people are ignorant of the facts, but certainly there's a large percentage of our population who listen to some of those voices that you raise. And unfortunately, it seems as if dialogue becomes very, very difficult. Could you share maybe examples of how you've been able to engage in meaningful dialogue with people who might come from that perspective or believe some of the things they hear from some of the more radical people on the other side?
Sure. And one of the best things to do is just simply to break down what Ceasefire Oregon does and what we've done in the past. Now, for example, the Ceasefire Oregon Education Foundation, who now does the gun turn-in, we let people know, look, if someone wants to turn in a weapon, it's their choice. You know, they don't have to do it. They're welcome to do it. It's their choice. They also deal with something called the ASK campaign, which is Asking Saves Kids.
Mm-hmm.
It's really simple. All it says is that if you've got, a child going over to someone else's home to play or to spend the night or something, just ask. If you have weapons in your home, please keep them locked up and unloaded while my child is there.
Mm-hmm.
It's very simple. It's very non-judgmental. And again, the vast majority of gun owners keep their weapons locked up and unloaded when they have children in the home.
Mm-hmm.
They're very adamant about that. I've talked to so many gun owners who say, oh, no, I've got a gun safe. I keep everything locked up. I keep the ammunition stored separately. So they're really great about that. So, yeah, that's definitely something a lot of gun owners believe in. Also, gun owners really believe in universal background checks. And rough estimate, we think about 40% of all gun sales do not undergo a background check, and that's nationwide. And we want to make people get a background check. It's a really simple step to do.
Penny, you said something really interesting there, and I think it bears repeating, and that is that many gun owners support the idea of a background check. Hearing that, can you pinpoint where the opposition is coming from that is presenting itself against background checks?
Oh, sure. Right. In Oregon, well, first of all, the NRA does not support background checks. The NRA...
The current manifestation.
Yes, the new incarnation of the NRA does not support it.
Right. And we can kind of talk about how that changed back in the 70s and 80s. But
mm-hmm.
There's also the biggest gun lobby here in Oregon bills itself as Oregon's only no-compromise gun lobby, which means they don't want anything. They think felons should have guns. They don't believe in any background checks. I'm sorry. Can you restate your question, please?
Well, basically, since the gun owners themselves support background checks,
okay.
You were explaining who is against it, and one of those opponents you mentioned was the National Rifle Association, NRA.
Right. And then the gun lobby here, they think that they're ineffective and they don't work. But we happen to know for a fact, for example, in Virginia passed with, now this is called universal background checks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And when they did that, they prohibited since 1989, they prohibited over 52,000 people from possessing a weapon who should not have by law possessed a weapon,
mm-hmm.
and that includes 16,000 felons.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that this works. And universal background check, if I may, can I explain this? Okay. Right now, when you purchase a weapon in Oregon, if you're purchasing through a federally licensed firearm dealer, that dealer is required by law to perform a background check. The background check simply means they call up the Oregon State Police, and the Oregon State Police run a background check. It usually takes a matter of minutes. If for whatever reason that background check can't be completed within, I think it's three business days, that person, the purchaser, can actually pick up the weapon anyway, even though the background check hasn't completely cleared,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty scary.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a federally licensed firearms dealer. If you go to a gun show, and in Oregon, a gun show is anything considered more than 25 weapons. If you are at a gun show, even if you're not a federally licensed firearms dealer, you still need to do a background check. You don't need to do a background check if you're selling fewer than 25 weapons. So, you know, if I'm going to buy a firearm from my neighbor, just one firearm, no background check needs to be done. Okay? And our law would actually change that, saying you must do a background check before transferring a weapon. There would be an exception for immediate family. So, for example, if someone has a 25-year-old daughter, someone who's old enough to possess a weapon, of course, legally, they have to be of legal age, then a background check wouldn't be necessary for immediate family. But everything else would have to go through a background check.
That seems to me to be a kind of a scary loophole, given the fact that sometimes that's, having a gun in a family is what facilitates suicide.
Actually, it's very true. It's a sad but true reality of gun ownership in America today.
I want to just emphasize again something that I think you said. Oftentimes, and I think one of our earlier callers said something similar to this, you know, if you have gun laws, only those who are outside the law will get guns. And you mentioned in terms of the Virginia law that it proved effective in keeping guns out of people who should not have guns. So it becomes effective.
It does become effective. It truly does. Now, there's something, we actually kind of work like with a model that Mothers Against Drunk Drivers had.
Mm-hmm.
The Mothers Against Drunk Drivers worked very successfully to reduce death due to drinking and driving.
Mm-hmm.
And they did so without banning alcohol, without banning cars, without banning anything. But they did so through a great campaign, Friends Don't Let Friends Drive Drunk, and also through stricter laws about alcohol and drinking.
Mm-hmm.
They even had a federal law. It's a federal law now, stating that blood alcohol level for drinking for being drunk is, I think, 0.08. Now that's a federal law as well, and that's something else that we can do too, because we know that these types of things work. Like over the last 20 years, for example, death by motor vehicle crashes is down by 31%, death by fires down by 38%. Death by drowning is down by 52%. And now all of this has been accomplished without bans, but with education campaigns and laws based on research.
Mm-hmm.
What is effective? What works best?
We have some other patient callers on the line. Good morning, Harvey.
Hi there. Thank you very much for the show. It's so important. And thank you, Penny, for doing the work.
Thank you.
But I have... The Grim Reaper is having a field day in America. But I have, you know, when I listen to the news, it seems that there's two things that kill people, guns and cars. But the difference between them is that cars are insured and guns are not. And here's an industry that privatizes the profits but socializes the losses. And we, the taxpayer, have to pick up hundreds of millions of dollars every year. A lot of people who get shot don't have insurance. They go to emergency, and sometimes it can run up to $500,000. And these people are disabled for life, so we take a loss. We're supporting them with our tax dollars, with care, in-home care, and everything like that. We are picking up the tab. The taxpayers are picking up. No one ever talks about this. So I feel that we have to insure guns. We have to, the death and destruction business, the insurance business, they know death and destruction. They will know how to, in a sense, create rules so that things are falling into place in a better way. And I feel that this is the missing thing. Imagine if we didn't have car insurance. we, the taxpayers, would have to pick up hundreds of billions of dollars in death and destruction thing. So I'm calling for insurance. Guns have to be insured like cars, this privatizing the profit and socializing the loss thing got to end, because it's just an industry running away, like you say, with the profits, and we pick up the tab. So I say that I'm calling for insurance for the gun buyers, and everybody has to come in, register their guns, pay insurance, and keep up with the regulations that the insurance companies will impose according to the business that they're running, for profit, too. So that's the name of the game there.
Thank you so much, Harvey.
Yeah.
Wow, that's great. That is. I've heard so much talk about requiring gun owners to have insurance, and I've actually seen a few bills kind of floating around here and there about requiring that. I don't know where they're going or if they're going to go anywhere, but it's something that a lot of people are definitely talking about. And he's very right that this is a case where you don't see the NRA not responsible for anything. You don't see them saying that they're going to help take care of the victims of Newtown. Mm-hmm. Are they going to help take care of the victims of Aurora? And I think one of the interesting things where this is going to wash out is finding out who is actually going to end up being sued and pay for all the medical care of all those victims in the Aurora, Colorado shooting. Is it going to be the movie theaters? I don't know who it's going to be, but someone's going to get sued for a lot of money, because the health care is going to be an enormous burden on society, like you said.
And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, LJ.
Hey, good morning, you guys. Thank you so much for opening up this conversation. I've just got a couple of quick points. Can we talk about the military-style assault weapons that are being produced and are on the street, and what the necessity of those are? Hunters don't use them. I don't understand the need for those guns to find their way into the market, into the general marketplace at all. And then can we also talk about New York City has what they call a stop and frisk law, which basically is racial profiling. They've already admitted it. And now how it impacts the people of color unfairly. As we know, another young Afro-American man, Kamari Gray, was just gunned down by two plainclothes police officers with a history of violence. This young man was shot 11 times. 7 of the bullet wounds entered his back, so he was essentially shot in the back. And these officers have a history of violence against people of color.
Well,
the city of New York, I understand, has already paid out $250,000 in lawsuits thanks to these guys.
LJ, okay, unfortunately, those are your 2 points. Here's our challenge here with the questions. The questions you bring up are great questions and points. However, we're trying to focus on the issue of violence in schools, gun violence in schools, and finding common grounds to discuss those so that we can come up with legislation that will allow schools to decide for themselves whether they're going to have guns in it. And unfortunately, your points are falling outside of that area.
Okay, well, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. They're great points for us to hold in our mind and think of while we're trying to frame this discussion. But unfortunately, if you had something that was relevant to that, I'd throw you the floor. But I just want to put a bookmark on your points. Thank you again so much for your call.
Uh-huh.
Bye-bye.
And we have another caller online. Ralph?
Good morning, Ralph.
Good morning. I'd like to make the point that the Second Amendment was designed to protect against an oppressive government, not to allow people to hunt or carry handguns,
mm-hmm.
but it was allowed everybody to carry guns so we could protect it against an oppressive government. So, I think if people in Nazi Germany, if the Jews had assault rifles, I really don't if they had them in their homes, I don't think they would have been rounded up.
So Ralph, we're not arguing about the Second Amendment right mm-hmm. now, but I'm wondering, I'm sure you are concerned about the level of gun violence. What do you think about some of the suggestions that have been discussed this morning to reduce gun violence? Not to reduce your ability to own guns, but
right.
to reduce gun violence.
And yeah, especially in schools.
I think the NRA is making good points to, you know, to look at video game violence, to look at mental health issues. I really wouldn't want to have my right to bear an assault rifle, which I do own assault rifles, mm-hmm. because I do feel the need to protect myself from the possibility of an oppressive government.
People said
Germany would never happen, but it did, and it could happen. I know people would say it never happened.
Okay, but let's reel it in. Okay, we're just talking. We're not saying you can't have your gun. We're saying, how do you feel about measures that we are looking at to limit gun violence in the schools? Now, I would assume because you're presenting, you know, a very rational argument here, that you see the value in having schools be a violence-free zone, correct?
Oh, for sure, yeah. Absolutely.
Okay, and I'm sure that as a responsible gun owner, you don't see the need to bring an assault weapon to school, correct?
Certainly not.
Okay, so how would you frame the conversation for us to communicate with your fellow gun owners so that we could bring down that level of fear that we're trying to take away guns, but rather focus on the fact that we want to have a space for our young people to learn without fear of violence, and especially gun violence?
Yeah, I think a better approach, seriously, is to look at the video game industry.
We got that on lock. We are doing that. But the thing is, in this particular, it's kind of like, you know, you got two hands, but they can only usually do one thing at a time. So we're trying to focus on just this one thing without excluding the other. So how would we focus on, and you're a great example here, how can we frame this argument so we can talk about preventing gun violence in schools? And you're a gun owner, and we want to hear your views on how to prevent gun violence in schools.
Okay, well, I think to prevent gun violence in schools, like I said, we need to look at mental health, we need to look at video games. Those are the points the NRA is making. The reason they're making the points is not to make Bushmaster more money to mm-hmm. sell assault rifles, but to protect our rights as citizens, to protect ourselves from an oppressive government. I personally would rather have an assault rifle if that came to the case.
Okay, let's let Penny answer that. Thank you, Penny.
Okay, we had already talked about mental health, and we're all for more mental health, and I would be very impressed if the NRA wanted to help pay for some of the mental health issues.
I was thinking that too.
Right. Let's turn to violent video games, which is what he brought up, and we actually have taken a look at the research on that. We've got Christopher Bartlett, who's a psychologist at the Iowa State University. He did a look at some studies, and he found what he termed are some short-term rudeness and aggression, but actually nothing long-term. Craig Anderson, who's also a psychologist at Iowa State University, he writes, actually, quote, violent media is one factor. It's not the largest factor, mm-hmm. but it's also not the smallest. So, and then there's also Michael Ward, who's actually an economist at the University of Texas at Arlington, has found that it's really inconclusive. So I wish that we could say that violent video games were the answer and we can just get, you know, rid of those or deal with those in whatever manner they need to be dealt with. But unfortunately, that's simply not the case. It's not really the violent video games that plays at most a small portion. I would like to address something. People often bring up Hitler and the Holocaust. And actually, it was the Weimar Republic, the government actually before Hitler had some gun laws. But if people really think that arming Jews would have stopped the Holocaust, then people really don't understand what the Holocaust was all about, mm-hmm. and it simply is not as easy as being able to arm people who are Jews. They really don't understand what the Holocaust is all about and the enormity of it and the scope of it.
We have a couple more callers. Let's see if we can get them in before the end of our program. Brian.
Morning. Boy, there's nothing like guns, religion, and stuff like that to get the phones lit up. Yeah, I come from a country where the cops don't even have guns. And, you know, we had our little pop guns when we were kids, and I always liked the Indians. But and we were in the aftermath of World War II, and, you know, we played at fighter pilots and all that. But it fades out if the stuff isn't there all around you all the time. You know, it's just, I've lived all over the world, and the countries in which citizens seem to be armed more, and I'm including Mexico here, seem to have heavily armed police too, and a very military kind of consciousness. And I don't think video games is the main reason either, because video games go all over the world. You know, they have video games in Britain, and they don't, the cops still don't have guns. And I've heard the same rationale as, I mean, I studied, you know, the wars deeply, but some idiot locally tried to make a wounded knee, you know, the rationale for, if the Indians had guns. Well, the Indians had guns, and it was all started by one young warrior's reluctance to give up his little pop gun, and, you know, the massacre was started, it was just an excuse to the remains of the 7th Cavalry were looking for to unleash Armageddon on the Bigfoot tribe. But what I'd like to say, my take on the, you know, school thing is education. You know, if you educate people that it's a human right to have a gun, kids starting at kids, then they're going to believe it and stick to their guns all their life and use the Second Amendment, which talks about a well-maintained militia, not a bunch of bloody warlords heavily armed. I mean, that's what the IRA sees its role as, I think. The IRA.
wrong country.
Yes.
My apologies to my Irish friends.
Hey, we have to move on.
Brian, we have to go now. We've got one other caller in just scant minutes, but thank you so much for making your points. Michael?
Yeah, you know, first of all, the German argument is ludicrous for the simple reason that when the government come, they're going to have a guy hundreds of miles away behind a computer sending a drone to you. And ain't nowhere in the world that your assault weapon is going to combat that. So that argument is dead. Also, you know, you can't separate school violence from societal violence. You know, everything is related here. That school violence don't exist in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. You have to stop violence in society as a whole. And the younger kids listen to the rap music. You're talking about videos. Shoot, the rap music is more instructive towards violence than maybe videos.
Well, not the whole genre of rap, but yeah.
Yeah, censorship, metal detectors, certain things like that. Because I used to go in clubs. And, you know, they used to warn you, search you. And there's less gun violence in nightclubs where there's alcohol and everything else than in schools. Now, that is a sad commentary on society.
Hey, thank you, Michael. You may want to comment on some of our last callers, but I also want you to share with our audience. I understand that on April 4th, there's a day of action to prevent gun violence at the Capitol.
Yes.
So we'll give you the last few minutes to expand on that or whatever you need to share, Penny.
No, thank you. I really appreciate that. Right, yes, April 4th. And we chose that day particularly because it will be the 45th anniversary of the assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And people choose fire for whatever reason. It happens to be a coincidence, but we're all very deeply moved and touched. And what he did and said really kind of changed the course of our lives in many ways. And so we really wanted to honor him, and we are asking people to come to the Capitol. We have a lot of events planned. Talk to your legislators. You can go to our website, ceasefireoregon.org. It's just all one word, ceasefireoregon.org, and you can sign up to come to the Day of Action. We'll get you set up so you can talk to your legislator. But, you know, I really want to leave people with the thought of, you know, what Brian had said and talked about, education, what your last caller said, about having respect education, respect, education, respect. It's incredibly important, not only for this issue, but for every issue. And also to think, where would we be today if the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. were still alive, if John F. Kennedy Jr. were still alive, Robert F. Kennedy, John Lennon. We lost all these people to gunshots. And I think we would have a better world today if they were with us still.
And if people want to participate and be a part of Ceasefire Oregon or learn more about your legislative bills and efforts, where do they go? What is your website?
You can go to ceasefireoregon.org. And there's actually, you can click on, it's a green link, actually, and it's just Ceasefire Oregon, and that'll take you to all of our information about our legislative work, and the other one will take you to our education campaign.
Thank you so much for joining us and sharing the work that you do, and we respect and honor you, and thank you for joining us this morning.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you. I have so much respect and honor for you. Thank you so much for this opportunity. I'm very grateful.
You're very welcome. And you are listening to Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. That's 90.7 in the Portland metro area, 91.9 Columbia River Gorge, 100.7 Willamette River Valley. On the web, it's kboo.fm. Stay tuned. We have coming up the Old Mo Variety Hour and more here on KBOO Portland. Are you a member? Become one.
San Francisco Bay Area is well known as the center for the renaissance of popular rock and roll in the 1960s and 70s. It was also the West Coast heart of traditional and acoustic music. The Good Old Persons, Kathy Kallick, Lori Lewis, Eric Thompson, Jody Stecker, and Kate Brislin are just some of the luminaries who made the Bay Area a vibrant acoustic music scene. On Friday, March 22nd, 12 noon to 3 p.m., I will be presenting a program devoted to the great acoustic San Francisco Bay musicians who are at the heart of the traditional music revival. I will have CDs by some of these musicians as thank you gifts for your essential support of community radio, KBOO. Tune in Friday, March 22nd, 12 noon to 3 p.m.
You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. The time is just coming around to 9 a.m. Up next is the Old Mole Variety Hour. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrill Hurst University's new Bachelor of Arts in Media and Film Studies, where you can explore how media in all forms affect not only how we view the world, but how we shape it. You'll learn the power of media and how you can use that power to become a participant in change. Now accepting applications. Details at merrillhurst.edu/KBOO. This program has also been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Aladdin Theater, presenting British guitar band Wishbone Ash performing their album Argus Live on Thursday, March 21st at 8 p.m. Tickets and information for Wishbone Ash at the Aladdin box office and aladdin-theater.com.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host, Ivan Hale, and our engineer today is Joe Clement. Every week, the Old Mole works to bring you political perspectives, news, philosophy, book reviews, movie reviews, and any other information relevant to keeping your leftist, Marxist, feminist, anarchist, queer chops intact. Yes, it's a big job, one the Old Mole Collective takes very seriously. We strive to offer voices and songs that you may not hear any other place. We strive to get to the root of the issue and dig around in the dark until light is shed and minds open to new ideas or fires get rekindled in old ones. The Old Mole Variety Hour has come a long way since its inception in 1990. And, like an aging rock band, we have original members but have also brought in new voices to add to the mix and the variety of Old Mole. We are old and new moles, and today's show will consist of just such a mixture. Starting off, Bill Resnick talks with Ellen Franks, an economist at University of Massachusetts in Boston, about the three dueling budget proposals currently under debate in Congress. Clayton Morgridge will explore the latest hot-button question, when can your government kill you? I will talk about the recent passing of Violence Against Women Act and its meaning for American Indian women. And Tom Becker will read an essay by Noam Chomsky. If we have time, which I believe we will, there will be some live recordings from the postal workers' rally that happened here in Portland over the weekend, and maybe we'll hear some poetry. It is the Old Mole Variety Hour, a vaudeville of politics and progressive thought. Hold still and stay tuned.
Hello, friends! Did you see my hat move around? It's fun to move around. Let's all play a game where we can move around and hold still. Hey, Plex, let's all play Hold Still.
Attention, everyone, it's fun game time, it's fun game time. Okay, everyone, it's time to play a game. Here's how we play. When I say wiggle, you move around and go crazy. And when I say hold still, you hold still like a statue. Got it? Okay, let's play. Here we go. 4, 3, 2, 1. Hold still.
Now that we've got some of our wiggles out, let's hold still and listen to Bill Resnick discuss three compelling federal budget proposals recently unveiled. And he'll be talking with